Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Hi, today we have Shane Lopez on the show. Shane is a senior scientist of Gallup and research coordinator of the Clifton Strengths Institute. His latest book is called Making Hope Happen, Create the Future You Want for Yourself and Others. Thanks, Shane, for being here.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You've been quite influenced on my own work and on a lot of people in the field of psychology. And how long is your career at this point?
Well, I started in positive psychology in 1999. I attended a positive psychology summit at Gallup in Lincoln, Nebraska. And there I got to meet Marty Seligman and Ed Diener and Mike Csikszentmihalyi. And I sat next to a wonderful man named Don Clifton, who came up with the Clifton Strengths Finder. So got to start working with him back in 99 as well.
Hey, so the Clifton Strengths Finder is not the same thing as the Character Strength Survey, the VIA
Correct.
Survey. Is there overlap between the kinds of strengths that are being measured by these two things, these two tests?
No, they're very different, actually. The Clifton Strengths Finder measures 34 themes of talent that with time, energy, and effort can be turned into strengths. So like my top five on the Clifton Strengths Finder are futuristic, maximizer, arranger, ideation, and strategic. And all these strengths kind of are associated with success in different ways. So instead of measuring character and virtue, the Clifton Strengths Finder measures talent and success.
I see. And talent being something that's not purely genetic.
Correct.
So how did he come up with this list?
Well, it goes back about 40 years. He was asked to measure the talent of people at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. They were trying to select better mentors for freshmen at the university. And it seems commonplace today, Scott, but his novel approach was, well, let me talk to the best of the best. I want to talk to the best mentors, and I'm going to measure the talent that they have, and then we'll look for more of that talent. In the past, what people would do was they'd basically say, you know, let me figure out who doesn't do this job well and try not to pick those things. So he just switched it up and said, I'm going to measure success and try to select for success.
And this is before the field of positive psychology even existed.
Yeah, this was back in the 60s, 60s and 70s. And he measured talent in mentors. He measured talent in ROTC members. And then he got into the working world and started measuring talent and strengths in managers and CEOs. And eventually, he even did work with the NBA and the NHL and the NFL.
Wow! So when did you start? Right now you're like what a senior research scientist there or a research director. I'm imagining that meeting in 1999, I imagine he didn't immediately appoint you that position. So how did that develop?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a geeky story. When they published the Clifton Strengths Finder in 98, they put it online. So it was one of the first psychological inventories to be online in a big way. And that explains why it's been administered about 11 million times to date. But when they published it, you know, it just took off, and lots of people were using it. And every now and then, somebody would ask for the psychometric report, the basic measurements guidelines, you know, that explain how reliable and valid the test would be. And they basically didn't have time to sit down and write it. They were so busy making sure that people were discovering their strengths. So that was my first task, was writing the psychometric report for the Clifton Strengths Finder. So fortunately, I did a really good job on that. And then I was able to land other work with them and then become part of the team.
Wow. So you split your time between lots of different things, I feel like. So you're partly still work with them, right?
Yeah.
You're also, do you teach?
I teach a little bit online these days. I used to be at the University of Kansas for a long time. I was a professor of education for 10 years and then a professor of business for 2 years. But now I mainly teach online and you know, one-offs, one-day teaching events. So I love teaching, but it's just not something I do every day now.
I mean, you're going to be teaching in my class.
I know.
Next week? Is that next week?
It's coming up. It's coming up. So positive psychology, how's that going for you?
Oh, I'm really enjoying it. Yeah, it's actually been a tremendous experience. Tremendous experience.
Good.
You'll get a chance to meet my students next week, virtually.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So I'm trying to understand this whole timeline here. So then at what point, I feel like your research on hope predated that 99 meeting.
Yeah, you and I share kind of part of an origin story. I started researching intelligence before I was researching hope.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I was at the one of my early jobs was at the Leavenworth VA Medical Center, and I was working with one of the top researchers on intelligence there. And enjoying the work, but as you know, intelligence only tells a small part of the story.
Oh yeah, definitely left me unfulfilled.
Exactly. So I had a very similar experience. So when I realized that intelligence only explained about a quarter of the variance in someone's success in life, and had nothing at all to do with their well-being, I just got somewhat disillusioned and started looking for other kinds of work to do, mainly looking for something that would explain someone's well-being, someone's happiness. And it was through my clinical work. So I was seeing a lot of clients, a lot of patients at the VA at the time. And I had this one patient who came into the clinic and at the time was suicidal. And he had abandoned all hope and he was pretty committed to ending his life. And we had to do some really intensive work to get him to a safe place and make sure that he was ready to move on. And it was in that clinical work that I discovered, you know, the power of hope in a person's life. And then I was fortunate enough to be working with Rick Snyder in a different capacity. And Rick Snyder was the University of Kansas psychologist who really operationalized hope and built this psychology of hope research body. And I was able to work with him and start researching hope in 97, 98.
Wow. It's what a tremendous opportunity to meet the legend.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, Snyder. And then I know he's been, would you say he's your most important mentor in your life?
Oh, by far. He started investing in me in a major way and giving me opportunities to do what I did best back in the 90s. And even though he's passed away, I feel like he said he gave us a lifetime guarantee on his mentoring, and it meant for our lifetimes. Mm. So I feel as though he's still mentoring me today.
So wonderful. And yeah, I remember I think it was his 1977 paper on abnormality as you need for uniqueness not being an indicator of abnormality. I just like blew my mind.
You have a good memory. That's one of his better regarded papers, and that work is really spread in terms of influence. It's still really big in the marketing arena.
Yeah, right. Advertising. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh yeah. All clothing is all about, you know, having people at least appear as though they're being unique when they all buy the same clothes.
And now cars today, people are trying to customize their cars in a way that sets them apart from other people. So his still work is still quite influential.
Yeah, absolutely. And he had a co-author, was it Fromkins?
Yep.
Now tell me who this person is. I've always wondered who this person is.
That person is kind of a mystery to me.
You too.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I almost was going to be embarrassed if you're like, this person's a legend, but actually I've never heard of this. I've been wondering who this person is.
No. And Rick was great about pulling people onto papers and tapping them for, you know, the contributions they could make. So you'll notice there are lots of folks. I mean, he rarely published a paper by himself. Every now and then he did, but he rarely published a paper by himself. And a lot of the folks he did publish with went on to have, you know, significant careers and contribute to the research. But there were some folks who were one-time authors, and I'm not sure if Fromkins was that person, but that kind of guy. But no, I don't know who Fromkins is.
I'm Googling him, Howard Fromkin. If any, I feel like, you know, if any of my listeners have any information on who Howard Fromkin is, please let us know.
It's the search for Howard Fromkin. I can see this. It's going to be a documentary one day.
I mean, he's like a co-author on one of my favorite papers of all time. And yet he's there's not a trace of him on the internet. It's just fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. I'll get over it. I'll get over it. Okay. So Hope, you got interest in Hope. And the thing that I think is interesting about the conceptualization of Hope that you got involved in is it's not a stereotypical conception of Hope. Even the way that Martin Seligman talks about Hope in the character strengths survey, like the way mm-hmm. Hope is defined as a character strength is different than the way you define it. Am I correct?
Yeah. Hope is about three types of thinking kind of combined. It's goals thinking plus pathways thinking plus agency thinking. So having that expectancy that something good will happen is kind of wrapped up into the goals thinking. And then coming up with multiple ways to get from where you are today to realizing that goal, that's what Rick called pathways thinking. And then having the necessary requisite energy and drive to get from where you are today to that goal is what he referred to as agency thinking. It's a social construct, but has a lot of cognitive components to it. And the way we have people remember it is GPA, goals thinking plus pathways thinking plus agency thinking.
Why do you think he decided to go beyond the traditional conceptualization of hope? I mean, he had to make an active decision to do that, right?
Yeah. He was really influenced by Carl Menninger. So I'm not sure if you remember the Menninger Clinic, but Carl Menninger wrote one of the first papers on hope. I think it was 1952. He wrote his presidential address for the American Psychiatric Association on the topic of hope. And in conversations with Dr. Menninger, Rick Snyder thought that it goes beyond expectancy, that there are other components. So if hope was to be really active in a person's life, you had to have that energy and drive combined with some routes to get from where you are to where you want to be. So he thought that his conceptualization was more robust and potent.
I see. And it's so interesting because like I feel like even today, like people use hope differently and you know, there isn't like a consensus in the literature. There's like, you know, there's like your and his conceptualization of hope. And then I see studies like in the positive psychology literature on like the link between cardiovascular disease, for instance. And I see optimism. Hope is used as a synonym for optimism. Have you noticed that too?
Yeah.
That must drive you crazy. You must head must explode when you see that.
It does.
If I was Shane Lopez, my head would explode if I saw that.
It does. And there are lots of folks who use one item measures of hope.
Yeah, exactly.
And that confuses the science as well. So, yeah. You know, it would be nice if we all agreed on one conceptualization of hope, but, you know, we let a thousand flowers bloom in positive psychology. And I think it deepens our understanding of what all positive expectations are, whether it's hope or optimism. But we do need to clean it up so that, you know, the folks outside our field can understand it better.
Absolutely. So tell me, and my listeners, why does hope matter?
Wow. You know, we're at the point where we can tell you pretty definitively why hope matters. And
just go for it.
Hope.
You've given TED Talks on this, right?
So. Yeah. Hope accounts for a letter grade in school. So if you're thinking about why hope matters to, let's say, a young person or a college student, how hopeful you are determines how well you'll do in school. So it accounts for a full letter grade of academic success. Wow. It accounts for a day's worth of productivity out of a 1 week, 7 day work week. So it certainly accounts for a whole bunch of projects getting done and burgers getting made and quarterly goals being met. And also it accounts for a 10% boost in well-being. So whether you're talking about success in schools, talking about success at work, or talking about happiness in life, hope is a really good indicator of how well you'll be doing.
That sounds great. And it's the kind of hope that you're talking about, where there's the will and the ways to get there.
The will and the ways, right. So that's agency and pathways, correct.
Is the will part, is that the same thing as like grit, as what Angela Duckworth is studying?
It's very close. It has significant overlap with grit, and it has a perseverance element to it. And it overlaps with all agentic thought. So it overlaps with self-determination. It overlaps with grit. And there's a whole body of research on the agentic self. So it overlaps with that research as well.
And from a big five personality perspective, do the different components of hope differentially correlate with different personality traits?
You know, not systematically. We haven't looked at that in a major way. But when we have the hope components, don't overlap systematically with conscientiousness and openness and the such.
But the wills and the ways that significantly correlates with each other.
Yeah, those are related at about a 0.4 correlation, correct.
So it's justified to call them both the same construct, an overarching construct, hope.
Yeah. It's a two-factor solution when we do the factor analysis.
Right.
But they're hanging together in a meaningful way and representing this operationalization of hope.
So why is the past not a preview?
Wow, you know, we put so much reliance on the past in determining how well we do today. So if you think about all that work, that the past is the best predictor of the future,
yes.
That's not really, really the truth in a lot of situations
life. Whoa, hold on. That's like a dramatic revising of what everyone thinks is true.
Well, you tell me. So intelligence. So your intelligence in the fifth grade, let's say, is that a great predictor of how well you'll do in the work world?
No,
right.
Not at all. No, I agree with you, brother. I agree with you. I'm just saying, like, let's digest this before you go on. Let's hold on, because that's going to be a revolution to some people listening to this.
Well, I think it's become an American ideal.
It has.
You know, it's something, you know, just like follow your passion is the hottest career advice. That's probably the most dangerous career advice, you know, that we have in America.
What should you be doing with your passion?
Well, you should be creating your passion while you're on the job.
Okay.
You should land a good job with great people and be systematic about doing so, and then create passion every day like you do with your work, Scott. Create passion every day and build it and then spread it to others. But the past is not a preview. I mean, when we look at just the measures that we hold up as big predictors of success, so whether it's intelligence, high school GPA, ACT, SAT scores, LSAT scores, those don't really tell us a whole lot about how people will do in the future. In fact, one of my colleagues, Kevin Rand, did a study looking at LSAT scores, the law school admission tests, and HOPE scores to determine ranking in law school. And HOPE was a better predictor of ranking in law school than the LSAT scores.
Yes, I love that finding. I cited that in Ungifted.
Well, in all these, you know, all these industries are built up, you know, basically around the notion that that the past is the best predictor of the future. And what we have to realize is the past is a predictor of the future. There's some knowledge to be gained from someone's past and past strivings and past successes and past demonstrated abilities, but there's so much more that we need to know, and the future pulls us forward in a way that that we need to understand a whole lot better.
I love that. So what are the implications there for our conceptualization of potential?
Wow. Yeah. You know, I think that's wide open. When we measure things like hope and even someone's strengths. So imagine if you knew someone's strengths, whether it's from the Values in Action survey or the Clifton Strengths Finder, and you knew someone's hope and you knew someone's grit. Wouldn't that tell you a whole lot more about their potential for doing a job well than just knowing high school GPA and intelligence?
I think so. I don't think everyone thinks so. So well, I think that you get a lot of diehard IO traditional people suggesting that, you know, they'll say, well, the reviews have shown that IQ is a better predictor than any personality trait. And if you add in personality, you get very slight incremental additions. Now, the way you worded it is in line with that. You said you basically said additionally.
Right.
That saves you because you said. but what if, like, you know, what if it's like very you only have a certain amount of time and you have to decide, or, you know, like I would be so bold as to say I'd pick the hope and grit over the IQ, and then that would get me in trouble. Like the way you worded it was perfectly, you know, like everyone's going to agree.
Yeah, I would. You know,
I'm putting you on the hot seat.
I hear you. I would want to know someone's, and this is how I do. I mean, I picked graduate students for years and years, and I cared a whole lot less about GRE scores than I did about their demonstrated abilities to get things done, number one, and number two, their vision of what they wanted to do in the future. And how compelled they were to pursue that future in a hot, passionate way.
Yes.
So I also picked graduate students based on their strengths. I needed reliable, dependable folks who had a lot to offer my team. Yes. So I picked a lot of graduate students, Scott, believe it or not, with GREs in verbal and quantitative under 500.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. And I knew I would have a lot of work to do with them around writing and you know, some stats work and things like that. But I also knew that they had potential that was untapped. And I was rewarded almost every single time. I can't say every single time, but right. I was rewarded almost every single time.
Wow. That's great. Thanks for telling me that. It's really great. So I think a lot of this does have implications for our education system then, in terms of selection into graduate and into college admissions, and but even going back further in terms of what we reward in the classroom. So let's talk about both, but let's start with going back to like elementary school or middle school. I mean, have you done work on interventions to see if these kinds of, if hope can be increased in school system?
We have, absolutely. I'll tell you about a neat project we did that we haven't tested the actual effectiveness of, but it's one that demonstrates the kind of interventions we could do in the future. At the Omaha Children's Museum, we worked with a tech company to build something called the Fantastic Future Me. Ooh. Yeah.
I like the sound of that.
Oh, it was really, it's a really cool, it's an ongoing exhibit at the Children's Museum, and about 250,000 kids go to this museum every year, so it gets played with quite a lot. And what you do as a little one, and these are typically 3 to 8 year olds, you stand in front of the Fantastic Future Me and you take a selfie. So the gadget takes a picture of you, and then you're able to crop it in just the right way so that your face shows up on the screen in this little oval. And then you pick from all these adornments of what you want to be in your future life. So we have 30 or so different outfits of different professionals and craftsmen and skilled workers of all types. And you adorn that picture of yourself with these different outfits. And then you become, let's say, a plumber astronaut because you can put on more than one outfit. Yeah. And then that picture is then sent to mom or dad via email to create conversations about what this little guy wants to be when they grow up. So that really is at the heart of all of our interventions, trying to get kids to figure out a story they can tell about their future selves. So as you and I know, and the listeners know, we're all strangers to our future selves.
Does that mean, Shane? What does that mean?
Well, you know, we don't really have
a... Speak for yourself, brother. I'm joking.
Present company excluded. I got it.
I'm joking. But
you know, we don't know really where we're going to end up in a year or 5 years. We can tell a story about it,
right.
But we don't know what circumstances of life will come about. So just like the way you landed the current job you're in, I mean, you couldn't have predicted how that would unfold in your life. You knew good things would happen, but you couldn't predict exactly where you'd be.
That's right.
Kids just have this, and I learned this from one of your writings as well. We all have this capacity for daydreaming. And what we try to do is aim that capacity for daydreaming at the future and get kids thinking about what they want to be in the future. So long story short, our 5-session programs that we do with kids, first we get them to focus on goals that they're wildly excited about. Then we get them to come up with pathways to those goals. And then finally we get them to come up with ways to maintain the will to get to those pathways. So it's very direct programming, but we've been able to demonstrate in both in elementary, middle, and high school that the program is effective. And in addition to that, another HOPE researcher out of Rick's lab created a 90-minute HOPE intervention for college freshmen that's very similar to the work we've done in schools. And he too was able to demonstrate, his name is David Feldman, he too was able to demonstrate that we're able to boost hope in these brief interventions.
Now, when you say effective, what are your dependent measures?
Yeah, we're most interested in hope increases. So we're actually doing test retest with post-test with Rick's hope measures, but we also look at satisfaction with life and other well-being measures. So the work we've done with students in Portugal showed that we were able to increase hope, but we were also able to increase satisfaction with life and overall well-being.
Oh, well, these are pretty important things.
Absolutely. And again, these are fairly brief interventions. So David Feldman's is 90 minutes and our interventions typically run about 5 40-minute sessions, so 200 minutes. So these are fairly brief interventions. And to date, we've been able to demonstrate that the changes are pretty stable. So if we come back 6 weeks or 6 months later, we still have that hope boost has been maintained.
That's great. And I know that you're also on the advisory board of the Future Project.
Yeah.
It seems so well aligned with your mission.
Well, they're doing just fantastic work. I mean, just imagine if we all had the benefit of having that kind of coaching in our lives. If someone was able to kind of help us figure out what our futures were going to be, and then rally us every day and keep us moving towards those coveted futures. Gosh, I mean, they could change high school in America, and that's. I'm betting on them to do that because we really need a big wow factor, something new and different in our high schools today. What happens in schools in America, Scott, and this is from the work I do at Gallup, on the Gallup student poll, is that kids get decreasingly engaged in school starting in about the sixth grade. So you're most engaged in school in the fifth grade. And then starting in the sixth grade and then seventh, eighth, and so on, you become less and less engaged. Yeah. So by the time you hit high school, a significant portion, around 50% of students, are not engaged in school.
Yeah.
So
a tragedy.
Oh my gosh, it certainly is, and we need some kind of disruption to help students become more engaged and pursue those dreams that may have gone dormant.
Yeah. That's an interesting idea. The dreams have gone dormant. What does that mean exactly?
Well, you know, my wife had
literally, what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, my wife had a not-for-profit in Omaha for a while where, she was having students, write stories about their futures, and then helping them, basically with learning how to write. But we had, I think it was 46 students in this program at one time. And, what was interesting is we asked them to write a story about, you know, their expectations for the future. And there was a different prompt, something much more engaging than that.
Yeah.
But a lot of students just stared back at us kind of doe-eyed. They really didn't, understand what they were supposed to be thinking about. Their capacity to think about the future hadn't been used in so long.
Yeah.
that the skill, the ability to do that, was just not there. So I think we have a lot of high schoolers walking around who have this wide open future, and really don't know how to describe it, really don't know how to pitch it, how to pursue it.
Yeah, I love that. A lot of P's. Come up with a new P model. okay, so what is feature casting? Did you coin that term?
Maybe. I don't know.
It's possible. You do.
It's possible. I hate to say I coined something when there might be someone out there who used it first.
Dude, you need more chutzpah than that. Own it. I've never heard anyone else use it before. until I hear someone else own it, I'm that's Shane Lopez.
Yeah, future casting is just what we do every day.
Yeah.
You know, in our thinking about the future. So it's not full on hope, but it's kind of what Babe Ruth did when he pointed toward the right field fence and said, I'm going to hit this out on you. You know, it's making big, bold predictions about your future. It's really putting yourself out there, having some chutzpah, as you said, and saying, you know, this is what I want my future to look like. And then when you announce it to the world, what's interesting is you get other people excited about it.
Yeah, or you get your parents not excited about it. But
do you have a story that relates to that, Scott?
No, I mean, no, but I can just imagine situations where you lay out there what you want to be, and that's not exactly what your parents envisioned for you.
Yeah, I would bet that's true. I talked to a guy last night whose 10-year-old daughter wants to be a fashion designer.
There you go.
And he's somewhat reserved about the whole notion, but is supporting her nonetheless. I mean, he sits up with her and watches Project Runway with her. So he's supporting her dream.
Oh, it's probably his favorite TV show as well. He probably loves it. Oh man. So yeah. So this future. So how can we have structures in an education system that facilitates future casting? Like, can we have like a future casting recess where everyone goes around and like talks about, like makes a bold declaration?
You know, we did that in a school system in Omaha, Nebraska. So Omaha is a hotbed of hope stuff because Gallup is located there.
Nebraska is a hotbed of hope. I'm quoting you on that.
It is. So a whole school district decided to have a future casting day.
Okay.
Where they did exactly what you said. They walked around and they spent time daydreaming about the future. So and writing down what they wanted for their own lives, but also for other people's lives. And what people realize is that we just don't spend enough time thinking about the future in a complex way. that we just let those flirty thoughts just pass us by, and we don't spend enough time engaging in our thoughts about the future. So I liken this to meditation. So when you're thinking about the present, you should be perfectly in the present. And you should meditate on the now and be as centered and present as you can be. But when you're thinking about the future, you should be perfectly in the future. You should be thinking about the future in a way that really is rewarding to you and helps you paint a picture of where you want to be in a week, or month, a year, and meditate on the future in such a way that it has some benefits for you.
So I would definitely agree with that. And I try to think of how your work is reconciled or compatible with Gabriel Odenjian's work.
Oh, sure.
I think that it's an unfortunate choice of words she uses to describe daydreaming. She calls it indulging.
Right.
Because I don't think, every daydream has to have reality. I think some of it in and of itself can be beneficial, not as always the means to an end. But that aside, I think that a big point of her excellent research is that, we can sometimes get lost in our daydreams or get trapped and forget that we actually need to put in some hard work to make this stuff happen. Mm-hmm. So if I'm correct, your conceptualization of hope explicitly addresses that point and says hope's not this sort of just blind optimism for the future, which is how actually some of the psychological literature describes it.
But right.
There's an active component to it. Is that correct?
There's an active component to it. And the most hopeful people we find are the most realistic people.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're actually testing out the future in a way that makes them less indulgent. So they're actually able to say, well, this pathway won't work. I mean, that's kind of out of bounds. This pathway won't work because I don't have those skills. This pathway will work because that's in my wheelhouse. Yeah. So hopeful people are, in the way we conceptualize hope, are actually more realistic folks than less hopeful people. Now, this whole notion, though, of indulging makes me think of wishing. And that, it does drive me bananas when people confuse hoping with wishing. Wishing is just so dangerous. I mean,
when
the whole
you wish upon a star, doesn't matter who you are.
Exactly.
So you're actually hating on that song right now?
I'm hating on that song, and I'm hating on the law of attraction and the secret and all of these.
Don't mess with Disney.
Oh, all of these disruptive forces that have captivated people and made people think that if you wish hard enough, your life will improve. And
dreams come true. I had to complete it, or else the audience would go crazy if I didn't.
Exactly. I could just feel the tension. Yeah. I just think wishing is quite destructive, and we could talk about that on a whole other show. But hope is more active; it has much more potential.
Yeah, so that's really these are really good, meaningful distinctions that we're making here today. This is like my podcast at its best, in my opinion, is when my guests and I can cannot just have 45 minutes of trite observations, but can actually make some useful distinctions for the audience. So, yeah, thank you.
You bet.
So I did say that we were going to talk about the school structure, but then beyond. So yeah. Let's just spend the next couple minutes, the last couple minutes of our interview, just talking about beyond. There's obviously a world beyond high school. College admissions. What can we do to change college admissions? How could you incorporate hope into the college admissions process? And then ultimately, as a full-fledged card-carrying adult, how can you make a decisive decision like that you're going to be more hopeful in your daily life? So both those things, if you could address them.
Yeah, and I'll go with the both and with college admissions. I'm not ready to say we shouldn't use the ACT and the SAT.
Right. Of course. Well, thankfully, you don't have to make that decision.
Well, there are universities that have abandoned both. So, but I'm not ready to say we should abandon both. I think that gives us some information about students, but I would love to see a couple of universities or small colleges try measuring hope alongside the ACT and SAT to determine selection. But what I do know is in the longitudinal studies we've done, and we have one paper out right now that we're trying to get published. In the longitudinal studies we've done, we've demonstrated that that hope definitely explains a good bit of the variance in students completing college on time. So when it comes to completing college in a 4-year stint, hope is definitely your ally. So I would encourage colleges to measure hope. I would encourage colleges to implement David Feldman's 90-minute hope intervention in their freshman orientation classes to boost hope. And then when it comes to being an adult, gosh, I can't think of where I'd be without hope in my life. You know, so on a personal level, you know, I was born poor and smart, and somehow I got a whole lot of hope, and that's what's carried me forward in my life. I mean, the intelligence has done some things for me, but really it's been the hope that pulls people to me. And those people then inspire more hope in me. And then I'm able to do things that I never thought possible as a young kid.
Absolutely. I developed a lot of hope along the way with inspiring teachers. And I really fundamentally believe that intelligence is malleable. Mm-hmm. That my hope and grit is what helped me develop whatever intelligence I have today.
Wow.
So so I have a huge ode to hope as well.
Mm. You
know? So I think that's just a great place to end this interview. Was there anything else you wanted to add about the current work that you're doing right now, or do you want to talk about anything else?
Well, right now I'm studying people who love their jobs, and I find that those two are some of the most hopeful people that I've ever met. So stay tuned. We'll talk more about hope and people who love their jobs next time.
Oh, that sounds great. I can't wait. Thanks so much, Shane. Really appreciate your time.
All right, Scott. Thank you. Thanks for all you do.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as informative and thought-provoking as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com.